I want to thank Pastor Rich, Pastor Adam, and for the elders and leaders for this opportunity to be with you. It's my distinct honor and privilege to share some of what I've been learning and experiencing in my ministry, not only at the seminary, but also through the ministry like CPR for pastors. And so, while if you look at the schedule, you'll notice there's a variety of different topics that we'll be discussing. This morning's topic is primarily geared toward pastors. And so, along the way, if you get a little bit confused, because I seem to be addressing pastors particularly, hang in there, because I believe this will be helpful for you who are not pastors, those of you who are leaders in the church, but even members of the church, to better understand what pastors go through and the challenges they face that oftentimes go unnoticed until the pastor quits. And there's a startling number of statistics that we're receiving, primarily research that we've been doing for about 20 years, me particularly, personally been involved for about 10, but it's a scary reality. And so I want to share some of that with you today, and hopefully it'll be encouraging, not only to the pastors in this room, but also to the leaders who want to better serve their pastors based on what we're learning today. So thank you for this opportunity, Pastor Rich, and glad to be here with you. I did notice on my way here from the hotel that you have more than just brown on the leaves in California. All of our trees are basically one shade of brown, not even two or three shades of brown, just one shade of brown. We're in a drought, but it's also California. Now, we do have beautiful beaches. I'm not sure if beaches exist here in Indiana, maybe along the lake. You can call that a beach, I'm not sure. But we do have beautiful beaches. But one of the things that you have here in the Midwest is beautiful, the fall foliage. I lived in Chicago for 3 years, and that was probably my favorite time of year. My wife and I would be able to, after church on a Sunday, we'd go out to the forest preserve and just see the vibrant hues. And almost the forest seemed to be on fire, the reds and the yellows. It's marvelous. So thank you for allowing me to enjoy that. And so it's been a joy. So today, this first lecture is entitled Shepherding the Shepherd. It may seem a little odd. Do pastors need ministry? Do shepherds need shepherding? And my thesis today is that they absolutely do. And so imagine with me, to begin with, that during this lecture, it was revealed, maybe halfway through this lecture, Pastor Rich came up in a hurry and said, "I'm sorry to interrupt this lecture, but the Center for Disease Control just issued this emergency announcement. No, Ebola has not hit Indiana, but a new strain of severe acute respiratory syndrome has now hit Indiana." Do you remember that disease several years ago? I think it was called SARS. Most of you knew it as SARS. And SARS was now rapidly spreading through the state of Indiana. And without immediate treatment, many could die from exposure to this epidemic. And so once you heard this announcement, what would you do? With all due respect to the church and to the speaker from California, you would probably leave right away and head to the nearest hospital or medical facility where you can get tested and treated. What if I were to tell you that there is an actual serious epidemic spreading across this country and that without treatment could lead to severe consequences? And what if I were to tell you that this particular strain specifically targets pastors in ministry? I've even given it a name. It's called SABS, Severe Acute Burnout Syndrome. Now, it's kind of a joke. Didn't go over very well, unfortunately. But as you'll soon see, my thesis today is that to have vital churches, and I think that's what we all want. We all want to be part of a vital, vibrant, healthy church that's growing in different ways. My thesis is that to have vital churches, we need to have vital pastors. That should be commonsensical in many ways. But as you'll soon see, a lot of churches and pastors don't recognize the importance of this thesis. Or put it another way, healthy and vital pastors yield healthy and vital churches. There's a correspondence between the health and vitality of the pastors and the health and vitality of the churches. When spiritually strong, emotionally healthy, and physically vibrant pastors lead churches, congregations tend to not only just survive, but actually thrive. And so what I want to do today is answer this, explore and answer this central question. What does it then take for pastors to survive and thrive in ministry? And so what I want to do is talk about pastoral health and its implications to successful and healthy ministry. And so here's the outline that I want to follow today. The central question is, what does it take to have pastors not only survive but thrive in ministry? Three things I want to discuss. What's actually happening to our pastors? You need to recognize that there's an epidemic actually in this country. There's a problem. Well, why is this happening? What's the cause to this problem? And then how can we fix it? Fairly simple, right? Problem, cause, solution, outline. That's what we'll be doing today. All right, so let's go ahead and take a look. First, what's going on? The problem, the challenges of ministry. Much of these statistics come from various sources, including our own research that we're doing at Westminster Seminary, but also Covenant Seminary, the PCA Denominational Seminary in St. Louis, as well as other institutes, Fuller Institute, the Schaefer Institute, and others. These statistics that I have now actually are a little bit dated. The ones that I'm going to show you right now are about 8 years old. They're based on about 1,000 pastors that have been surveyed, but they'll give you a picture of the problem that pastors and churches are facing today. Hours and pay is one area. Did you know that 90% of the pastors report working between 55 to 75 hours per week? 90%. Many of you may say, good, that's what we pay them for. Maybe, I'm not sure if the pastors will say that. Half of the pastors feel unable to meet the demands of the job. 70% of pastors feel grossly underpaid. And this is not what I'm saying about this church or your church or anything like that. This is just statistically what we're finding throughout the country. So just in the area of hours and pay, this is becoming a problem. What about in the area of training and preparation? 90% feel that they're inadequately trained to cope with the ministry demands that they face. That's a large percentage. 9 out of 10 pastors. 9 out of 10 pastors said that the ministry was completely different than what they thought it would be before they entered the ministry. So that's training and preparedness. And that means a lot to me as a seminary professor as well. What about in terms of health and well-being? Did you know that 90% of pastors feel frequently fatigued? 70% of pastors constantly fight depression. 7 out of 10. 50% of pastors feel so discouraged that they would leave the ministry if they could, but they have no other way to make a living. Can you imagine being in a situation like that? Or maybe you don't. You know of somebody, or maybe it's you. What about in terms of the cost on the marriage and family? 80% of pastors believe pastoral ministry has negatively affected their families. 80% of spouses feel the pastor is overworked. 80% of spouses feel left out and underappreciated by church members. Thirty percent of pastors were divorced or currently in the process. What about in terms of church relationships? 70% of pastors that we've surveyed do not have someone they consider even a close friend. They experience tremendous isolation and loneliness. And we'll talk about the reasons why. 40% of pastors report serious conflict with a parishioner at least once per month. And the number one reason why pastors leave the ministry, church people are not willing to go the same direction of the pastor. Vision differences, decision differences, etc. That's normal. But it gets so bad that the pastor feels like he has to leave rather than cause conflict or division within the church. So in light of all this, what about pastors' longevity? How long do they last in our churches? 50% of ministers will not last their first 5 years. That's a serious epidemic. Only 1 out of every 10 ministers will actually retire as a minister in some form. Only 1 in 10 will actually go the long haul and survive and retire as a pastor. Only 1 in 10. 4,000 churches about begin each year and 7,000 churches close. Just every month, about 1,700 pastors leave the ministry. Over 1,300 pastors were terminated by the local church each month, many without cause. And in terms of people in the church, over 3,500 people per day left the church last year. So as you can see here, just by the silence and by the worried look on all of your faces, you can see that SABS is a problem. It's a problem. It's a problem affecting our pastors, and then it ultimately impacts our churches as well. And so again, to have vital churches that impact our communities, that impact our families, impacts this nation, we need to have vital pastors. But the problem is pastors who are often alone, depressed, discouraged, have horrible family life. They'd rather sell insurance, perhaps, than go through all the pain and misery of ministry. So, in light of all that, why is this happening? Two helpful books, I think help us understand some of the causes to this pastoral burnout, to unhealthy pastors, which leads to oftentimes unhealthy churches and people leaving the ministry. This particular study, Pastors in Transitions, Why Clergy Leave the Local Church Ministry, was a study of pastors in five different denominations. It's kind of hard to see in the red there. I apologize. I chose the wrong font. There's the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which is the conservative side of the Evangelical Church, Assemblies of God, United Methodist Church, and the PCUSA. The process involved 200 ministers were selected from each denomination, so about 1,000 churches. Out of a questionnaire that was sent to 1,963, that's a really high statistical rate, 963 people responded. Moreover, 10% of them were interviewed by phone for extended conversations, as well as there were focus groups. And then denominational leaders were also interviewed. And so what did we discover in terms of the causes? Now we're talking about the causes of why pastors leave the ministry. These are some of the results that this study discovered. The number one reason why pastors leave the ministry is because of an experience of stressful conflict. But there are other conflicts as well. Disputes over what we would call pastoral leadership style, kind of relational issues, finances, where to spend the money of the church. You have different people within the church, leaders, as well as lay people, who want the money of the church to be used a certain way. So there's going to be some difference in decisions that need to be made, changes in worship style. There are other reasons. Let me back up here. Other reasons included staff conflict, differences over a building, new building or renovation. That actually happens a lot, as well as other changes. So this book attributes these reasons for some of the causes. There's another interesting book called God's Potters. It was a study done by Jackson Carroll, who's a professor of sociology of religion at Duke University. He studied 1,200 pastors from four categories of churches rather than particular denominations. Again, you can't see that, but four categories of churches: conservative Protestant, mainline Protestant, historic black churches, and Catholic churches. And what did they discover? Issues that weaken commitment, foster dissatisfaction, and affect health negatively were these issues. What were the causes? Inadequate compensation, congregational conflict, stress, obviously, pastoral roles, meaning the inability for pastors to manage the difference between the public life and the private life, that when they're in public, they act and live a certain way, but in private, they have a totally different life altogether. And in fact, there's a great book that I'll mention later. It's a new book that just came out by Paul Tripp, pastor and professor, called Dangerous Calling, in which he highlights this problem of this division between the public and private life of the pastor and how dangerous that is. So that issue, the experience of loneliness and isolation. And so these are some of the reasons or the causes why pastors are leaving the ministry, which causes churches to become unhealthy and weak. And so in light of that, what's interesting about this book is based on their research, they actually come up with some solutions on their own. I thought this would be interesting to compare some of their results with some of what we've been discovering in our own research. So they actually argue that to strengthen pastoral leadership and nurture excellence, they recommend four strategies or four solutions. As we now transition to solutions, they say early on, even before pastors become pastors or they go to seminary, we in the church level need to help pastors recruit future pastors with excellence. So they call that. I'll talk about these in turn. Theological education for excellence. What are we doing in our seminaries? What can we be doing better to prepare our pastors so they don't burn out? Congregational and denominational practices that support excellence. What can churches do in light of this problem to help our pastors and future pastors? And then pastors themselves, what can they do? And so let me talk about those in turn real quick. In terms of recruiting for excellence, they argue that previously in our churches, we used to have better ways to recruit pastors in the future. But now what we find are these problems, the loss of infrastructural support. What they mean by that is, previously in the history of the American church, the church and school, especially parochial schools, were much more intertwined. And so many children used to attend Christian schools, for example, where the idea of entering the pastoral ministry was a little bit more common. We don't see that nowadays. We don't see that kind of connection between the church and school, etc. Furthermore, we have loss of familial support. Whereas before, going into the ministry was a source of pride for the family. Nowadays, when you tell your parents you want to go into ministry, they say, are you sure you want to do that? You do want to feed your family, don't you? And have a future, etc. That's what we actually see in the Korean-American church, especially now, more and more. One of the fastest growing churches in the world today is the Korean church in Korea. The Korean church is only about 100 years old. Started around the early 1900s or so when Presbyterian missionaries came to Korea. If you're interested about that history, it's a fascinating history, a very unique history. You'll have to come tomorrow morning to the Sunday school class. I'll give a lecture on the unique things that happened in Korea over the last 100 years. But from nothing, you now have a church that now encompasses about 25 to 30% of the population. The population of Korea is about 50 million. And so now think, a quarter of that, at least, is now Christian as a result of God's blessing upon that nation. For the first time ever in 100 years, the Korean church is no longer growing. In the last 3 to 4 years, it's actually stabilized or it's actually now shrinking. There are many reasons why. We could talk about this tomorrow. But I think one of the reasons why is that this loss of familial support. Whereas before, it was somewhat of an honorable thing to enter into the ministry, to do good to society, to spread God's kingdom. But now, families, parents especially, would rather have their kids go to the university, go to graduate schools, and become, like good Asian parents we are, lawyers, doctors, but no, not a minister. Heaven forbid. So we have many tiger moms and tiger dads, as we, I don't know if you know about this book. And yes, I am one as well, unfortunately. And so I don't want my kids to become pastors. Thankfully, they're both daughters, and in my denomination, I don't have to worry about that. But I still remember one of my young daughters, Emma's now 14, she's a high schooler. But ever since she was about 5 or 6, she just really looked up to what I did. She goes, Daddy, can I be a pastor? I said, let's pray about that. You don't want to squelch a 6-year-old's dream. But you have this now. You have this change or shift within the family, not only in Korea, but even in the United States. So in light of this, Jackson Carroll and his team recommend certain things that we can do to offset this problem. They argue that we need to enhance what's called a congregational culture of call. This is what they argue. That if the congregation understands their role and having a call by God, not necessarily to be a pastor, but to be called by God, the general call, that is, of believers, to be involved in the ministry in their own way. Not to necessarily preach or to perform marriages or things like that than only ministers can do. But if Christians understand that they're also called by God to be involved in the work of the ministry, and that culture of calling is normalized within the church, then it's easier for young people who want to consider the ministry to become ministers. And so they argue that we need to enhance the culture, the congregational culture of call. They also say that pastors themselves need to support the call to ministry through their own preaching and teaching, holding up the vocation to ordain ministry as a viable life commitment, not only to the church as a whole, but even individually. Pastors need to model it better. Personal example of passion for ministry that's contagious is another way to help young people consider the ministry. Partnering with conferences and seminaries and other larger groups, partnering with other people to think about this. And in many ways, if you're not from this church, that's one way that we're doing that, is working with churches in this community. What can we do to help Bloomington grow? Well, to have Bloomington grow in Christ, we need to have vital churches that reach this community. Well, how do we reach this community? Well, we need to have one component is to have healthy pastors and more pastors in the future. That's what the argument is. And then commitment to financial support, meaning do what we can at church as churches to not only support current pastors so they're not stressed out about their lives, but then commit to even setting aside money in the budget to supporting young men who want to go into the ministry so they don't have so much debt when they go into seminary. So that's just one area. I'll just quickly go through this because we need to move on. But theological education for excellence, they argue that unfortunately what's happening right now is that churches are not doing their job to help pastors grow. So they're relying too much on this kind of compartmentalization of education. There's not this kind of holistic understanding of helping young men going into the ministry with the church, the family, and the seminary all working in conjunction to one another. What we're doing is, oh, you want to go to the ministry? Good for you. I'll pray for you. Good luck on the finances and good luck on your future. And they ship them off to seminary thinking that seminary will take care of everything. And unfortunately, the seminary cannot do it all. We need to partner together. Unfortunately, that's the problem. Furthermore, more and more students than ever before are coming to seminary not having what we call the kind of pre-seminary socialization. More than ever before, I've been now at the seminary for 15 years at Westminster. And what's interesting is more than ever before, more than half of our incoming seminary students became Christians after college or during college or after. So many of our seminary students have not had the kind of experience, history, and training of a Christian home, of a Christian school, etc. So what we're doing is we had our curriculum established in such a way that we need to assume that many of them come with a certain amount of understanding, experience. I'm like, no, actually, no, we don't have that. In fact, we're having to do a lot of kind of pre-seminary education. Even just education on knowledge of the English Bible. You'd be surprised at how many of our students just don't know even their Bible, let alone how to write a research paper with a thesis and an argument. You laugh, but it's true. It's true. You know, and I'm sure Indiana University is the exception, of course, but many of the universities in our country are becoming so compartmentalized in their understanding of education. It's very outcomes-based. So if you go into an engineering program or a computer science program, you do very well in that subject. But how do you write and articulate an argument with certain evidences and then come to a conclusion? You would think that that's fairly simple. You'd be shocked at how many of our seminary students don't even know how to do that. And so we're having to start, kind of go back and start over with a lot of things. And so in light of that problem, and then lastly, the intersection between theory and practice is difficult to golf. In light of that, they recommend several different things. That they actually argue, interestingly enough, that distance education or kind of video education that's becoming very popular today does not help in terms of graduate seminary education. So they actually argue for residential education in that kind of crucible of experience where you're rubbing shoulders with other students and faculty is very formative for future pastors and actually helps them survive for the long haul. So they're actually arguing for, if you want to go to seminary, go to the school, live there, breathe there, laugh, cry. All that it takes for you to become a better person, not just become a better pastor. It's character development as well as competency development that's very important. Adding a fourth year to the MDiv, I don't know if you know, but most MDiv curriculums in the United States require about 3 years of education for a graduate school. They actually argue that they should add another fourth. A one-year addition between the third and fourth year, where for 1 year after 2 years of education, they go off to a partner church and they do a one-year internship for that experience. Then they come back in their fourth year and finish off that with that experience. I think it's very helpful. Unfortunately, many seminaries would cry, no way, we can't do that. Many churches will say we can't do that. And unfortunately, many students will say we can't do that for various reasons. It's unfortunate. But I think that's a very interesting idea. And then continuing eduflection programs, they argue that basically education plus reflection need to be more incorporated into theological education. So third, let me just go through these really quick. We're running out of time. As you can see, I can talk about this for a long time. But the problem of compensation issues, congregations themselves need to think carefully about compensation. Unfortunately, the majority, if not supermajority, of pastors serve in churches that are generally small, less than 150 members. And to a number, I want to say about the numbers are like 80 to 90% of those pastors are grossly underpaid, unfortunately. And as a result, it leads to a host of other problems. But so what are some of the solutions there? We need more education and information to help churches and church leadership to think about what it takes to live adequately in a city like Bloomington, for example, as opposed to San Diego, California. Denominational support. If your church is part of a denomination, this is where a denomination can help. Supporting seminarians through scholarships and supporting pastors through regular vacations, support for continuing education, and sabbatical leaves. We'll talk about that again. What? My pastor needs more vacation? We give him 2 weeks. Isn't that enough? We'll talk. We actually do need, they need more time away. And then lastly, clergy themselves, ministers taking responsibility for their own discipline, etc., for their own health and vitality. They need to take responsibility by developing regular spiritual disciplines, developing habits of reflection, becoming lifelong learners, nurturing holy friendships. We'll talk about this in a little bit more. Maintaining appropriate boundaries between church and home. Being diligent in maintaining even good physical and emotional health are other ways that they suggest. Ultimately, their goal, again, is similar to mine in our research, to have healthy, vibrant, vital churches that impact their community. You need to have healthy, vibrant, vital pastors. And here are some of the solutions. So, in light of all this, what about our research? Our research has come up with 5 different areas in which pastors and churches need to think carefully in order to have healthy and vibrant churches, which presupposes healthy and vibrant pastors. And these 5 categories we've kind of put under these headings. Spiritual formation, personal development, and emotional intelligence. That's in the life of the pastor himself. The individual pastor need to be attuned to these things in terms of then his relationship to his immediate family. The pastor needs to be very careful in that relationship. And then lastly, outside of that circle, we're moving out in kind of concentric circles in terms of leadership and management of the church and people within the church. And so one way to view these 5 different categories of pastoral health are thinking about it in terms of concentric circles. For the pastor himself, these are 3 areas that the pastor needs to be concerned with. And then also, the pastor, within the larger context of his marriage and family, very, very important. And then in terms of leadership and management. So this is another way of looking at these 5 categories. It's within those 3 contexts. Or you can think about it in terms of 5 different categories over time developing. So what I'd like to do over the next, let's say, 10 minutes is cover these 5 areas. And you're probably working out the math in your mind. 10 minutes, 5 areas. Dr. Kim, that's 2 minutes each. I don't think it's going to take 2 minutes. But that's the goal, because I'm looking at the clock here. But that's what we're going to try to do. Because a lot of these categories we've also already talked about. And I do want to get some of your questions and concerns and even maybe some complaints if you have them. So the first one is the area of spiritual formation. Let me define this. Basically, to have healthy and vital pastors, our research has discovered that pastors need to be involved in the ongoing process of maturing as a Christian on both a personal and interpersonal level. And these levels interact. The personal and the interpersonal levels interact with one another and are generally reflected in lifestyle disciplines and behaviors. That's a fancy definition of basically saying Christians, pastors need to be careful to just continue to grow as a Christ follower. Not only for themselves, but also in terms of their relationships. So the centerpiece of this definition is this phrase, process of maturing. It's easy to assume that pastors are engaged in this, right? Because after all, this is what they do. They study the Bible. They help others grow. So surely they're growing themselves. What our research is showing is that they're not. Many, many pastors are involved in the tasks of ministry. Preparing the Sunday sermon. Preparing their Bible study. Meeting with people and helping others grow. But all of these activities essentially become just tasks of the ministry. A job to fill. And inside, they're growing cold and dry. Because they themselves are not being careful to their own spiritual growth and their own spiritual maturity. One pastor said this in our interviews. He said, "I may be a pastor, but I'm an inch deep. My life is filled with incessant activity, but little prayer. Contemplation? That's foreign in my vocabulary and frankly, non-existent in my life." And so what happens is when pastors neglect this important area of spiritual formation is that personal growth is supplanted or replaced by just spiritual tasks for ministry. And they get cold and dry. And they have little left in the tank, not only for themselves, but especially their family. The most important group outside of themselves, so to speak. The most important spiritual task of a pastor is to minister to their family. And they're the ones that get the last little scraps of the pastor. Furthermore, another part of the definition there is the personal and interpersonal. It goes without saying that we cannot grow as Christians without others. Christianity exists in community. That's why we have the church, a physical representation of the body of Christ. So clearly the Bible teaches that we grow with one another. But the person who's often not with others, side by side growing, is actually the leader of the church. Leaders of the church often feel very isolated and alone for various reasons. One, they find it very difficult to share their problems and concerns. How can they admit to their elders? How can they admit to their congregation that they don't have it all together? That they're burning out, that they're broken, hurting people, that they're struggling in their marriage. How can they admit that to their churches? If they admit that, are they admitting defeat? Will people think that they don't have the abilities and the leadership and the maturity to lead them? Many pastors feel that they can't share that. What if it costs me my job? What does this mean for my family? And so this horrible cycle ensues. And this is what we're seeing in many of our pastors. The sense of isolation and loneliness. And they have no one they can turn to for their growth and help. And so that's what they're finding, is they're very lonely. They don't have the interpersonal relationships. And furthermore, it's not reflected in their lifestyle. So in light of all that, what are some suggestions that our research offers to pastors? Finding time in their lives for undivided worship. It's very important for pastors. I apologize, it's in the red. I don't know why I chose red. It seems so ominous. Huh? I'm not sure. That's it. That's right. That's exactly right. Out of my deference to Indiana University, I chose red, of course. So pastors need to find time for personal and corporate worship. Have you ever thought of this? Maybe there are pastors in this room. I'm a pastor. Early on in my ministry, 20 years ago, when I was pastoring a church, when you're on a Sunday morning, the last thing I think of is, "Lord, I'm so glad to be here to worship you." I'm like, do I have checklist? And then because I'm a people pleaser, I'm going to admit that right up front. I want people to like me. I don't know if you're like me, but I'm a people pleaser. So I get up here and go, is the worship running smoothly? People unhappy? Are they bored? Etc. So that's all I'm thinking about during the worship. Can you imagine what that does to an individual? Let alone the pastor of a church. If that's his experience every Sunday, now multiply that by 52 and times that by how many years? If a pastor is unable to worship on a Sunday, what will that do to his heart and his relationship to God? I'm not saying it's easy. But this is where pastors need to be very careful about what it means to worship the Lord even as they're worshiping with their congregation. But even personally, Paul Tripp in his book Dangerous Calling argues that pastors need to learn throughout the day, every day, to learn how to preach the gospel to themselves. Every day. Preaching the gospel, reminding ourselves that we're actually much more sinful than we thought. And yet, we're more loved, more accepted, and more valued by God than we ever dared hope. And so when we understand the gospel, we grow in our maturity. So pastors need to find time for worship. They need to establish and maintain spiritual disciplines. Of course, the primary way to do that is by going to church, frankly. Listening to the sermon, even the sermon that they're preaching. Hopefully pastors are preaching to themselves as well when they talk about the law and the gospel. But other ways, other practices that I think are very helpful. Fasting, stewardship, witness, other spiritual disciplines. And then having accountable relationships. And this is a theme that's going to come up over and over again. It's pastors finding others, trusting people that will help them in their spiritual direction. Not necessarily tell them what to do, but people who can listen and help in their growth. All right, so first thing that they need to do is be attuned to their spiritual formation. Secondly, is personal development. Now that we talked about the spiritual aspect of the pastor's life, we also want to talk about the physical aspect of the pastor's life. Because as humans, created in the image of God, we're both body and soul, right? And what we're finding in our research is that because of the spiritual tasks of ministry that take up so much time, pastors are not taking care of their bodies. Interestingly, the National Institute of Health did a research on just pastors and found that 78% of clergy in the United States, three-fourths, unfortunately I'm in this statistic, 78% of clergy are either overweight or obese. Not Pastor Rich. Apparently he runs marathons. Is that true? I heard that you run and you're very healthy. So, which is great. He's taking care of his body, not only for himself, but for his family and for his church. But unfortunately, not many people are. So personal development is this focusing on the ongoing growth of a pastor and his physical well-being. Interestingly, a Scottish pastor in the 19th century, Robert Murray McShane, maybe some of you know him, made this interesting comment about his body. He said, God gave me a gospel. I'm not going to do a Scottish accent. It'll probably sound kind of halfway Korean, that's why. Scottish Korean. God gave me the gospel. No. God gave me the gospel and a horse, he said. And by horse, he was talking about his own body. God gave me the gospel and a horse. I've killed the horse, so now I can no longer preach the gospel. And so for pastors to survive for the long haul and not become a statistic, what do they need to do? They need to manage their lives holistically. They need to be very careful about managing not only their souls, but even their bodies. Think of that, how those are very interrelated. And I'm actually doing more research now in the area of neuroscience. And how actually our brains impact even our bodies, and our brains even impact our emotions and our souls. And that makes sense because we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And so they need to manage their lives holistically. They need to develop safe and trustworthy relationships. The physical act of having others in your life is so important, isn't it? Perhaps some of you have read research or heard about research about people who heal faster just by physical touch of people in the hospital with them. The physical touch of others is so helpful. That just goes to show you the importance of the body and the soul working together. But these relationships, not that you have to have people touch you. That's not what I'm saying. Find people who will touch you and you'll be a better pastor. Or you can help your pastor. That's not what I'm saying. I hope you'll understand what I'm trying to say. I don't need to nuance that, but just in case, let me just articulate the obvious. What I'm talking about here is finding people who will help pastors and in their growth, and then prioritizing their growth and development by good nutrition, exercise, family time, alone time, friend time, family, etc. It's interesting. One of the pastors in our research and our study came to one of our retreats. Very, very busy pastor, a Korean immigrant pastor, and as a Korean immigrant pastor here in the United States, very, very busy. Because in the immigrant context, you're not just a pastor, but also you're a social worker. You're an immigrant expert, you know, so you have to do everything for many immigrants that come from Korea. And oftentimes it's the pastor that leads in all of these things. So you can imagine the amount of work, the amount of time that they put into their church ministry. Furthermore, in the Korean culture, vacation is somewhat looked down upon because it's not very spiritual. Why do pastors need vacation? They've been specially anointed by God. So clearly they have like superhuman powers. And they no need rest and recreation. I kid you not, this is essentially a Korean cultural ethic, unfortunately. And so they carry that over into the church. And so what you have is you have pastors that are incredibly overworked. Interestingly, at one of our pastoral retreats, so we designed a program where pastors can leave their church for a week and come and just... We would have morning classes. We'd have afternoon classes. Like we'd invite a chef to come in and do classes on nutrition for pastors and their wives, which is unheard of. We would do exercise programs. We'd have programs at the pool. We'd take them to play golf. We'd go on botany trips. We'd invite professors to come and teach them about nature. It's a wonderful program. I was able to enjoy that just as a director of that. One of our pastors during one of the days started experiencing heart palpitations. Heart was starting to race, and he felt he was having a heart attack. So we immediately called 911. The ambulance came, and these paramedics are working over him. It was very scary for us. Whisked him away to the hospital. I thought one of these pastors were going to die as a result of one of my programs. I go to visit the pastor later on that evening. I go to the hospital, visit with him, and I say, "How are you doing? Is everything okay? What's wrong?" He goes, he actually kind of chuckled. Pastor Sam was his name. He goes, "This is kind of embarrassing, but actually there's nothing wrong with my heart. Physically, I'm fine. My heart is fine. Everything is fine. What basically I had was a panic attack. Apparently, it was the adrenaline of doing so much work for the church that kept me going. Only when I felt relaxed did something happen in my body. It's coming to this retreat that my physical body showed me that something was wrong. So when I actually relaxed and had nothing to worry about, my body freaked out." Isn't that crazy? It was only through this opportunity to relax that his body said something's wrong. And so he then had to change his whole lifestyle, talk to his elders. "I think something needs to change here. You may not have a pastor for long." And so it was interesting how even in our own experience, we've seen the importance of personal development. Third, emotional intelligence. And this may sound a little bit weird, but essentially what I mean by that is this was a term coined by different researchers, especially by the book, and scholar by the name of Daniel Goleman. He wrote a book called Working with Emotional Intelligence many years ago. Basically, this is saying pastors need to have relational wisdom. Again, this seems so obvious, but you'd be surprised at how many pastors don't have relational wisdom. And so emotional intelligence is defined this way. It's the ability to understand our personality and feelings in order to appropriately manage ourselves personally and socially. It is largely learned through family and other relationships, but it also continues to develop as we go through life. But it includes characteristics such as self-awareness, self-control, motivation, empathy, and relational skills. We're discovering that pastors need to understand this more than ever before, because if the number one reason why they leave the ministry is due to stressful conflict with others, whether on staff or with the church, it's rarely due to the actual issue. Did you know that? I don't know if you've experienced this in your own life, but have you ever gotten to a fight with a loved one? Your spouse, your children, your family, other people that you love. how that seems to just snowball and it's no longer about the actual issue of whether or not I'm going to mow the lawn once a week or once every 2 weeks. That's no longer the issue. It's like, why do you have to talk that way? Why are you screaming? I'm not yelling. No, you're yelling at me now. Yes, you are yelling at me now. And then it just kind of snowballs. Largely, that's due to this inability to manage your emotions, to not have Christian, what we call, self-control. And pastors need to be aware of that and grow in their ability to manage their emotions in a godly, biblical, Christian, but also wise way. And so pastors need to understand that to survive for the long haul, they need to attend to the emotional intelligence in several areas. And I know this sounds kind of touchy-feely, but we're discovering again this is very important. To identify, manage, and appropriately express their feelings. Many, many of the pastors that are involved in our programs had difficulty even sharing their feelings of even hurt, disappointment, brokenness, depression. They don't want to even admit it. So they need to identify it, manage it, express it, but also develop relational skills with boundaries. Learn how to manage emotionally their relationships between their family, their church, etc. And then lastly, learn how to handle conflict better. One particular ministry that I'm involved in, I'm on the board of directors for a ministry called Peacemakers. Peacemakers Ministry, very valuable ministry. And so if you as pastors or leaders have not done it already, please read the book, The Peacemaker by Ken Sandy. And if you're a church member, buy the book for your pastor. Buy the book for your elders. So the most important investments that they will make is learning about conflict and how to resolve it biblically. It will help them tremendously. And frankly, it'll make the ministry go out of business. But that's a good thing. We want our ministry to go out of business. We don't want conflict in our churches. We don't want conflict in the pastor's family. We want the gospel to heal relationships, to heal churches. And one way to do that is by learning how to handle conflict. Okay. Last couple of things. These are common sense things now. The pastor in relation to the marriage and family. This is the pastor's commitment and the church's commitment and the family's commitment to maintaining spiritual and relational health with one's spouse, children, and extended family. The pastor, it goes without saying, needs the focus. And the church needs to support the pastor in supporting the spiritual and relational health of the spouse, children, and a family. And one way to do that is by understanding the strategic role the wife plays in the life and ministry. Oftentimes, the wives are called by our pastors my toxic dumping ground. Let me explain. Pastors oftentimes do not have anybody with whom they can share their concerns, their struggles, their conflicts, their anger, their frustration, their bitterness. So who do they turn to? They come home and they share with their wife. Literally, they dump everything that's toxic about their lives with their wife because they realize that with their wife they can at least have a safe relationship. What happens to a person that all they receive is toxic stuff all the time? Or, in terms of balance, more toxic stuff rather than healthy stuff for their growth? So what we're finding is that not only pastors are burning out, but pastors' wives are burning out. And so we need to be aware of that problem and how can we help our wives. I have some suggestions, but also invest time and energy into his marriage and family. But also help the pastors assist their spouse and children to develop safe and trustworthy relationships. They don't have to do the burden themselves or carry the burden. And then lastly, maintaining good leadership and management skills. Helping our pastors develop further skills in leading their congregation, leading their families, but also managing their families and managing their congregation. Two primary levels of pastoral vocation. Pastors don't want to admit this, but a lot of their work is based on, is it just administration, managing people and leading the church. They thought going into ministry meant studying the Bible and praying and doing that for the majority of their time. Unfortunately, it's not. The supermajority of their time is spent in administration and, unfortunately, counseling. Not that counseling is bad, I'm not saying that. But I think a lot of pastors go into this ministry without realistic expectations of what's required of them. Furthermore, our seminaries are not doing a good job of preparing them for the realistic expectations of ministry. We're not training them in leadership and management skills, unfortunately. We just expect them to learn it or know it just from their own life or experience. That's not the case. We're now having to rethink how to prepare our pastors for the future. And this is one way of me trying to encourage you as congregation members. What can you do to help your pastors in terms of the leadership and management skills? So one way to do that is by helping them understand and accept their role. It's okay, pastor. You need to be a leader. You need to be a manager. That's part of your responsibility. And to that end, we want to help you. Help you learn how to trust God in the midst of these circumstances. A lot of pastors, unfortunately, struggle with their faith. What? Yes, pastors too struggle with their faith. They're human. And especially when they encounter leadership conflict, management conflict, they start to doubt whether or not, God, are you in this? I don't know if I can do this anymore. It's too hard. Can I really trust you in this process? So we need to help them be attentive even to the political realities of ministries. Politics, yes. Wherever two or three are gathered, there is politics. As you know. Politics, not only in the bad sense of people trying to manipulate to get their way, but politics can also be defined in a good way of helping to manage various values and what they think are important for the church. A pastor's job is to manage all of those different values. How do we help our pastors do that? So, in light of all that, these five things are the areas we need to help our pastors so they can survive for the long haul. In light of what's happening here. So some concluding thoughts. I'll finish with this. What do we need to do? We need more understanding. We need more information and understanding for our pastors and for our churches. There are books that I've mentioned, as well as books like Paul Tripp, that will help you as congregation member, help you as leaders, help you as pastors understand the problems that, if you haven't faced it already, you will face. It's like the weather in Hawaii. I have a friend that comes from Hawaii. He said, if you don't like the weather, just wait 5 minutes. Because it'll rain really hard in Hawaii, even in the summer. But in 5 minutes, it'll be sunny and blue all over again. It's like that. If you think everything's okay right now at church, just wait 5 minutes. Things will happen because we're sinful people in the sinful world. And so in light of that, we need more understanding, information. We need more conversation. Conversation between pastors themselves. Conversations between pastors and their leaders. Conversations between pastors and their church members. Pastors and their spouses. Members of the church. So more conversation is needed to help have vital pastors so that we can have vital churches. And then lastly, we need more application. We need help to put this into practice, help our pastors. And so some examples are just helping our pastors with their time management, providing continuing education for them, have it as part of the church budget to send them away to conferences where they can grow and learn. Physical checkups. Have you ever asked your pastor, Pastor, when's the last time you had a physical checkup? Kind of seems awkward, but it's actually really important. So now I do that with my senior pastor. I'm an associate pastor. So I make sure that he goes to see the doctor every year. I'm kind of an annoyance, but he's actually grateful for it. And then providing counseling opportunities, not only for your pastor, but for his family. And so pastors need to review these things so that they can thrive. And that's what we want. We want our pastors to thrive, to be passionate, to love what they're doing. Because when you have pastors that are passionate, you get to be passionate. We have passionate people that will impact and be contagious to their congregation. And so we need that. So let me offer a couple of other things. Paul Tripp was very helpful in his book, Dangerous Calling, and he offers these things. He says, require the pastor to a small group. This is kind of weird. Okay, I don't know why it's doing that. Require the pastor to attend a small group he doesn't lead. So you have pastors you all need to be a part of a community group or a small group for your own growth and maturity. But I don't have to. That's essentially what he's saying, right? Or, if the pastor is in a small group, is he's leading one? No. Have him attend one just as a member. So that he and his family could just enjoy that fellowship and growth. Establish a pastor's wives small group. Maybe the pastor's wives in this community, even from different churches, can gather together for mutual support and encouragement. How wonderful would that be? A safe place where they can complain about their husbands, for example. And they don't have to worry, so to speak. You know what I mean, hopefully. Make sure that there's someone who regularly mentors your pastor's wife. Does your pastor's wife have an older woman in the church or somebody that they can turn to for their support and encouragement and help? Be sure that your family and his family, pastor and his family, are regularly invited into the homes of families in your church. Again, these seem like common sense things, but you'd be surprised at how this doesn't happen in the majority of the churches in the United States. The pastors and their families are so isolated and alone. Because again, everybody assumes, they don't need help. They're good. They're healthy. They don't need us. They do. What are some other things? Make sure that your pastor and his wife have the means to be regularly out of the house and away for weekends with one another. It's very, very important. Make sure counseling help is always available to the pastor, his wife, and their family. And then for the pastor himself, seek out a spiritually mature person to mentor you at all times. Pastor, do you have a mentor? And pastor, be committed to appropriate self-disclosure, even in your preaching. That's what Paul Tripp recommends. That's something very healthy when a pastor is able to even share appropriately how he struggles and how the gospel has changed him and is changing him. And so, in light of that, let me just finish off with these two verses that I think are so important about pastoral health. Remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls and those who will have to give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. Pastoral ministry is hard enough with just the tasks, but we don't have to make it harder on them. One way to help them is by understanding the struggles that they face and supporting them practically, spiritually, physically. So my hope through this lecture and this talk is giving you kind of a better window to the life of the pastor and what we can do to help them thrive so that you yourself will thrive for the sake of the community around you. Thank you. Let me finish by confessing I have lied. I want to be I said 10 minutes, but I didn't go 10 minutes faster. I apologize. So I want to be authentic and vulnerable and say I'm a liar. Hi, my name is Julius, and I'm a liar. So forgive me for that. But yeah, if you don't, I'd be happy to take some questions. And then I do want to give you a preview of what's coming up too. I won't have as many slides and stuff, but we will talk about the Bible too, I promise, in the next talk. Yes?
I just retired at the end of June after 40 years as a pastor.
Yes.
Self-disclosure. It seems to me that one of the elephants in the room in all of these problems, at least as I've observed it and as I've reflected relative to myself, is this one person truly called to the ministry? I think of a man I know who's 90 odd now, I think, good man, far better man than I am, who was many, many years in the pastorate, and I remember him saying to me, after he had quit, I suppose he was in his 60s when he quit, actually, went back to being, went to being an electrician. He said, I feel that I get up at the pulpit and nobody is listening to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to say that there was a problem of communication of just the gift.
Sure.
You know, this poor soul, good man as he is, just really dust in public.
Mm-hmm.
So, reflections on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I actually skipped that part because of time. But in one of the sections in terms of spiritual formation, as well as spiritual direction, is a section of determining call. And as you know, determining one's call to the ministry is a multifaceted factor, meaning there's several different things at play there. Not only the internal sense of, do I even have a desire? Am I excited about God's Word, about preaching God's Word, sharing God's Word? Do I even love people? Do I want to help people? Do I have that desire in my heart? But that's only one part of the call. As you know, the other part is the external sense, meaning do other people in the church, people that I trust, my parents, my pastor, my elders, do they see certain gifts and abilities for the pastoral ministry? Do they sense a pastoral heart and sensitivity and sympathy toward others? And then lastly, not only those people in our life, but the church. Has the church ultimately tested me to qualify me to do this ministry? And unfortunately, even when all of those things line up, people make mistakes. And they go into the ministry and they realize, you know what? I really don't like people, unfortunately. Ministry would be great without the people. And they come to the conclusion, I just don't have that gift, so to speak. I jest, of course. But you know, I think you understand what I mean. It would be great if I can just come up here and preach and just not talk to anybody afterwards. In fact, that would be great, frankly. But that's not pastoring. That's not being a shepherd. Shepherd is being with, loving your sheep, where they're hurting, when they're hungry, when they need protection. And you have to have a special heart and a gifting for that. And unfortunately, not many people do. And so they encounter these problems when they haven't wrestled through some of those issues carefully enough. And again, every denomination is different. I want to be sensitive to that. And at least in my Presbyterian denomination, there's a fairly rigorous process that we go through to ensure that this young man, for example, knows A, that he's getting into this, and then B, if he's even qualified or competent to do so. But not every church is like that. I used to be part of a denomination when I was young, where basically the church said, hey, if you got the gifting, we're going to ordain you right now. Now you're a pastor, without any kind of training or something. And I think there are positives and negatives to that, but I think the more careful process is always wiser. For example, you would never go to a medical doctor, would you, that didn't have the degrees on his wall that say board certified, graduated from this med school. You would never have him cut open your heart and do heart surgery. Never. That would be unheard of. Why would we want a pastor who wasn't board certified, who had the training to open up your spiritual heart, which is perhaps even more important? And so my argument has always been for thorough, rigorous education and training for the sake of people's hearts, souls. And so, because I'm part of that tradition and that understanding, that somehow offsets that problem of bringing people into the ministry that are not ready or prepared or even called or gifted. But yes, that is an issue. But for sake of time, I kind of put that off to them. But excellent observation and question. Thank you. One more question? Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And oftentimes I don't think it's for lack of caring. I think it's really just ignorance. Not in a bad way, but we just don't think of it. We just assume we come to church like we approach a lot of things in life. You know, the pastor is another person that we pay to provide a service for me. Unfortunately, that's how we think of it. So that's his job. We pay him to do his job. And as long as he does his job well, he's happy, we're happy. Well, no, actually, the ministry is more than just a job. And in fact, there's much more involved with that, not only the physical, but even the spiritual and the emotional. So you're exactly right. And I think it's through books like Paul Tripp's and others, these other books, as well as hopefully lectures like this, that help open the eyes of members of the church and leaders to say, hey, our pastors are people too. And they need our support, they need our help, even physically and emotionally. So hopefully I've accomplished a little bit of that through this talk. But thank you. Thank you for your time.